do begin.
Hey, what is up, guys, and welcome back to another episode of the podcast. Today, my guest is Alfonso Gomez Rejon. He is a director of The Current War, The Director's Cut, Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, and The Town That Dreaded Sundown. On top of that, he's had the opportunity to work on shows like Glee, American Horror Story, and most recently, Hunters on Amazon Prime. Now, it was awesome having Alfonso on the podcast. Definitely something that I was looking forward to for a couple of weeks as we got closer to the date. Only because I had the chance to see some of the movies beforehand, before knowing that he was behind it. And then once, you know, I had the opportunity to get in contact with him, I thought it was great, you know, having the opportunity to kind of sit down with the person who was directing those films. So I hope you guys enjoyed the conversation. I don't want to give too much away. And if you guys have the time, which being that it is still quarantine time and we still got to be inside and whatnot, you have time to watch the movies. So, I mean, you got plenty of time. I'm pretty sure by this time, everything on Netflix, on Hulu, on most of these streaming services, I'm pretty sure you're either watching the same thing over and over, which, talking about The Office, I know you're out there, people. And hey, I do too, so can't blame you. But ultimately, it's up to you. Life is made of choices, and you make the choice that you prefer. But you should make the right choice, and the right choice is to check them out. Nonetheless, today's music is brought to you by La Onda with their song Precious. You can find them on YouTube and Spotify, and obviously Instagram. So go check them out, follow their music, give them a like, add them to your playlist, do whatever you gotta do, but support these guys and let the good times roll. We'll see you next time. Hey, what is up, guys, and welcome back to another episode of the Social Primate Podcast. Today, my guest is the great Alfonso Gomez Rejon. He is a director of a couple of films, such as The Town That Dreaded Sundown, Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, The Current War, The Director's Cut. And from my understanding, you've also had the opportunity to direct some episodes with Glee and American Horror Story. And most recently, you've done Hunters on Amazon Prime. Thank you for taking the time and coming out here.
Thanks for having me.
For those people who haven't heard of your work, tell us a little bit about that. Like, how did you get into all of this?
I don't know how interesting it is, but I was, you know, raised on the Texas-Mexican border, mm-hmm. which is a much different border than what it is now. It was much smaller. It was basically one city divided by a river, but it was really just one city, the Mexican side and the American side, and it was so fluid, and it didn't really start separating and becoming two countries, really, until, mm-hmm. like, you really started to feel it post-NAFTA, post-9/11, post-cartel wars. Mm. But it was a really beautiful way of life that I think only with time did I realize how special it was.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, so you were born and raised there pretty much your
whole youth? On the Mexican side, but raised Mexican. Mm. I mean, sorry, on the American side, but raised Mexican. Ah, okay. As in, we weren't allowed to speak English at home. We spent, you know, half of our time was, you know, half your friends are from one side, mm-hmm. and all my family was on the Mexican side. My grandparents were on the Mexican side, and they were very strict. My parents, my dad was from, you know, the Yucatan, and my mm-hmm. mom's from Mexico City. And then little by little, they made their way to the border for different reasons. And then right before my older brother was born, mm-hmm. they moved to the American side of the border. But it was literally like crossing the street. There was no real difference from one side to another, mm-hmm. you know, everyone's Mexican.
Yeah.
And it just depends on when you're on the American side. I think my parents were very protective of our language, our culture, but mm-hmm. really language, because as with every generation, things start to get lost.
Yeah, of course.
And then there were, you know, when you're on the border, there's all these other cultures there too. So it was a very kind of unique way, I guess, of a beautiful way of growing up. And but the well, I was most lucky in that I had great parents mm-hmm. who always pushed the arts or allowed us to explore the arts. And mm-hmm. they had three kids that were all artists. So there were fears of a career mm-hmm. in the arts. But my older brother was the first to kind of break down those barriers with a career in music yeah. and my sister in fine arts. And then my brother now has a tequila line called Rajon.
Oh, nice.
My sister's now a chef and an art historian, has her own company here called Art Bites, and I became a filmmaker, but they're the ones that that started to, I guess my parents started to get used to the idea of now they're third and youngest having yeah. a career in the arts. But they just always supported us, even if they didn't fully understand it.
That's good. Yeah, that's actually one of the questions I kind of wanted to touch base on first, because like I'm the oldest, you know, I'm technically first generation. My parents are from Mexico, but and I do graphic design, and I know that wasn't their thing at first. They were like, what are you going to do that for? Like, where is your future in that? And of course, there's different areas that you can jump into, but they were very against the idea of an artist. Like an artist or creative in the family, because they didn't see it suitable to what they sacrificed themselves to come here for, you know? So it was kind of this weird, it's still kind of weird now, but there's just more support now, you know? Mm-hmm. But there's a whole different culture at that time, you know, in the way that we're being approached.
Well, me wanting to make movies was like going to Mars. It didn't make any sense. Okay. Now there's like there's a great,
yeah.
A really good friend of mine from high school runs the film department at the mm-hmm. university. But none of that existed, you know. None of it existed. Yeah. So my access was through it was the beginning of the VHS revolution. So that mm-hmm. was my access to film, to mm-hmm. film history, because yeah. it was obviously pre-internet. And when you're in a small town, you have like a fourplex in the mall,
yeah.
and then the one downtown that gets all the old films from, you know, they go there and die.
Yeah.
And it was through that, but it was hard to put into words why I needed to do it,
mm-hmm.
but it just felt right for me for a number of reasons. And I became really kind of obsessed with, at that point, I got my hands on Scorsese on Scorsese,
yeah.
the Faber and Faber. Faber and Faber put out this, it was, you know, it's a British kind of publishing house that puts out a series of film history books and mm-hmm. and a lot of directors talking about themselves and their lives and Scorsese's kind of became kind of my Bible. I try to watch every movie that he referenced, mm-hmm. and ultimately though, when I had to kind of create my own path, the only one I knew was New York University. That felt right to me because he went there. Do the Right Thing had come out recently, mm-hmm. and that really changed me in a lot of ways. Oliver Stone had come from there, and Jim Jarmusch. It just felt like the place for me without yeah. really knowing why, and I applied, and I got in, and that just became the path that I was yeah. just kind of... And then it was like, will I survive?
Yeah, right.
And it was incredibly intimidating going to New York, not so much of the city, which I always loved, mm-hmm. and I felt right at home, but... you know, just surrounded by so many people. I remember everyone just felt was so kind of type A, and everyone was like on all the time, and I was so insecure and like timid. And but then, you know, you start doing the work, and the work speaks for itself, and you start yeah. getting a little more confidence because people start noticing you and talking to you. And then that was kind of it just kind of underscored how comfortable I was making films or yeah. on a set without having really a lot of experience before that.
Now, when you started, I mean, when the fascination with the whole idea of film, like mm-hmm. when did that happen for you?
That's a good question. I started watching movies. It's only because I was, this sounds silly, but I was afraid of the dark. I was mm-hmm. afraid to sleep alone. I was afraid of, so I was always staying up until I collapsed, you know, yeah. and watching like HBO, whatever's on TV. Letterman until eventually I just couldn't take it anymore and it's just time to go to school again. Yeah, knock out. Yeah. But I was TV really was created this like safe space for me. But I was always an artist. I was mm-hmm. always drawing, sculpting. We were all artists all the time, so we were encouraged to paint and draw since, as far as I can remember. So that was something that I always had. And then just discovering films and discovering different points of views. And I started to pick up on a Lynch movie or Scorsese movie. And I started to kind of study the craft, mm-hmm. you know, editing patterns and camera moves and staging. And then when I saw Mean Streets on VHS, that stirred something up in me that I hadn't felt before, when I felt like someone was talking directly to me. And that movie was so much about a lot of what I was feeling. Mm-hmm. You know, that's 1970s Little Italy, and it was not that, but it tapped into something that I was going through at the time and transcended kind of words and cultures and everything.
Yeah.
And that made me feel what was possible. And then I started to see all his movies again mm-hmm. through a new lens. And then all the films that started to really speak to me were films that ended up being incredibly personal to the people that made them. Mm-hmm. And around the same time, like, my house was mainly music. But a friend's brother lent me a VHS of Apocalypse Now.
Oh, yes.
And then when I discovered Blue Velvet, that was, you know, I'd have screenings at my house for some of my friends because it was just, it was like another universe that I had been tapped into, and it just felt right. And then watching whatever I could about the making of, because this was like, they didn't have a lot of documentaries on the making of stuff.
Like behind the scenes. Yeah, behind the scenes.
It was like the making of Michael Jackson's Thriller, which mm-hmm. was huge.
Yeah.
In the 80s, when there was nothing else out there, you could see how the cameras move and how the director would direct, and there was a little, occasionally there'd be something that you'd see on, there was a show called Lights, Camera, Action that Leonard Nimoy hosted, but there's very little. So it was just about studying that and studying MTV, 120 minutes, like all these, it was like art house cinema. And yeah. Like, and then eventually you kind of go through everything. And then when I got to school, I really felt I knew nothing. And I just started watching at Bope's library at NYU, like a couple of films a day.
Just kind of like analyzing them and...
But just soaking everything in. I just felt I was so far behind everybody else. And then I realized even people that were from big cities hadn't mm-hmm. really taken advantage of what was right there in front of them. You know? So I was surprised that my film history knowledge was pretty good. But it's never good enough, you know. So it became a passion to kind of learn as much as I could about the history of, you know, the world that I had chosen to be in.
Damn.
And then, which is also incredibly humbling, because mm-hmm. you realize how little you know.
Yeah, right.
Or it's all been told before. So it's like, how do you interpret
the
language that exists into your own, you know?
Man, I'm going to get into that right now. You know, a lot mm-hmm. of us, you know, we kind of try to forge our own paths based on what we have interest in. But it's easier for us to kind of like start having self-doubt when we're on our way to whatever we're working towards, mm-hmm. right? Like for you, like at what point did you decide like, this is what I want to do? And even with the lows and everything, you were like, I'm going to keep pushing through.
I mean, I'm all self-doubt.
Yeah.
I'm all self-doubt. Yeah. I was almost more driven when I was 17. but it just, there's nothing else, man. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's, the highs are so high.
Yeah.
And when you tap into something, whether it's an entire experience that just, or that just kind of, you're able to communicate what you were feeling, or sometimes it's in the act of doing it, when everything kind of works, when the camera move or not move, and mm-hmm. the right expression with the right this, the right that, it's real magic. You know, it's just, but if you, what I learned is, it's much more than that. If you're able to literally communicate what you're expressing, what you're feeling, through, you know, this, you know, through camera and through performances and all that, that's just the way I express myself.
Yeah.
You know, that's the best I can do. I'm not very good in the real world. I'm not very good with words, you know, but in that moment, I feel very much whole.
Yeah. Yeah. You're like in that zone. You get in that zone.
But the self-doubt is always there, and it's always the fear. I wake up and I'm not going to know where to put the camera. I'm not going to, you know, it's like, it's the constant fear and the butterflies and not sleeping. And then you get a rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
And then right when you start feeling confident, everything goes to shit. You know?
That happens, right?
Yeah. But it's always going to keep you on your toes and it reminds you that you're nothing. But it's, but you have something in your head.
Yeah.
that you want to say in your heart. And it, honestly, it's as cliche as it sounds, that's what keeps you up and keeps you going, because you need to say something, and maybe at the end of it, you know, you'd be able to hang it on the wall.
Yeah.
And that's who I was, and this is a record of my best and what I was going through at the time, and is expressed in whatever genre, whatever it is, and to great success or not, and then you move on, hopefully.
Yeah. Now, during that whole progress, I mean, from when you first started getting your hands on camera till now, have you at any point crossed your mind, like, man, this is not going to work out? What will I do? Like, what was your alternative?
I had no alternative.
Oh, damn. Okay.
No plan B. Yeah. I forgot to mention one thing of my mom early on, of how she would project Super 8 films for us as kids. Mm-hmm. Family films, sometimes short Walt Disney films I think they were Disney. And it was the whole ritual of clearing a dresser in my bedroom, lowering the lights, spooling the Super 8 film, and then total silence, projecting on a white wall. It was like a little movie theater. It's a very religious kind of experience. Yeah. And I remember the silence, because all silent films in the room, and the mixed emotions of seeing your loved ones younger, your loved ones alive, whatever the case may be, your birth, whatever it is. And then, of course, the unspooling of the film and the burning of the film and her splicing it. It was all these rituals that I was just in awe of. And I think that the magic of that also seeped in way before I was able to express it. But as far as like a plan B, I didn't really have one. I have other interests, like art history or like architecture, things like that. But even at my lowest, and there were some times that are obviously dark, but there was just nothing else. Mm-hmm. You know, there is nothing else. You know, I can't think of anything else I would rather do, even when it hurts so bad.
No, sometimes. I mean, that makes sense, you know, because that, like, giving yourself that option, the opportunity to have a plan B, it gives you, like, this sense of security that if, oh, this fails, I'm just going to give up on this, and I'm just going to move on to this next, you know?
I think I have... My plan B was, like, unconditional love for my parents. It was just, like, kind of, like, you know, I lost my dad already, but there was, like, there's a safety or an illusion of, like, you're going to be okay, which I'm very fortunate. But as far as career, I didn't really... Once I decided to do it, I was very determined, and part of it is ego.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to do it, and everybody... knew I was going to do it, and it was like, I was again like this, you know, this is a long time ago, and it didn't make any sense to anyone. Mm-hmm. But there was a fear of public failure after that. It's like, how am I going to tell everyone I didn't make it, you know?
Yeah.
Not to say that I've made it, but it was something was driving me to just be, you know, the thing my dad would always say, just trying to, you know, strive for excellence, and I just wanted to be good,
or
the best I could be.
Do you think at this point you're still like pursuing that each and every time you do it?
Of course, yeah. No, it's always on the edge of. I mean, the last film I did, Current War, you know, was a very problematic post because of the Harvey Weinstein thing, and it's hard to disentangle my film from that scandal and the movement and everything. And that was a very, really hard time of people either not seeing the movie or judging it. Yeah. And always tying it into the other juicier story.
Exactly.
As opposed to seeing... So that gets complicated sometimes, but I'm proud of the movie, so I'm not, you know... I'm really proud of that I was able to get it back and do say what I wanted to say with it. But, yeah, there are times when you just think it's you're never going to work again. But some of the greatest actors I've ever worked with always feel that they're doing is going to be the last thing ever.
Yeah.
It's just like this always this fear that I think it keeps you alive, you know, and pushing yourself to for greatness or good work or whatever it is.
You know, you've worn a bunch of hats over the last few years until you started directing on your own. For you personally and maybe professionally, like, do you have any... any lessons that you've learned from working with, because I think you've worked with Martin Scorsese yourself, right?
Yeah,
like you were an assistant with him?
Yes.
Yeah, like, how was that, first of all? I mean, you were watching his videos.
It was
amazing.
It was a dream, yeah.
Yeah, right?
Because I was obsessed with him.
Yeah.
And I went to NYU and he had a session with a guidance counselor or some kind of counselor. And they said, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to work for Scorsese. And he says, look around. Every guy or every person here has the exact same dream.
Yeah.
That was like 2 weeks into New York. So it was crushing. But yeah, 3 years later, or 2.5 years later, I was working for him. And it was the fear of meeting your heroes. But but I didn't have any. I wanted to meet him. I had no fear. Yeah. And then it just became. He was even a greater kind of giant. And through him, I met Thelma Schoonmaker and Nicholas Pileggi and all these great people that have been, and through him, Nora Ephron, all these people that have really given me a seat at the table and recognized, maybe saw something in me that I didn't, but opened me up to just like a very high kind of bar that they would set over and over again. And you still, what was wonderful about that is that he's a genius, he's a master, but there's always a fear that's always there. Mm-hmm. Now, when I saw it, I realized, oh, some things don't go away, no matter what, how much he's succeeding. I think there's certainly confidence in the body of work and all that speaks for itself, but there's always a little of that fear, because it is ultimately, and for all artists, it's a bit of a mystery.
Yeah. No, that's why when I found out, you were working with these directors that have like weight on their, or experience under their belt with great films and everything, the idea that you were working so closely or at least assisting these people, I would imagine it was just a way of solidifying your path into what you were going to do, And now that you say that you'll go behind the scenes and see all these other videos and study them, being actually there on set, well, I'm sure that completely changed the perspective in what you wanted to do, right?
Everything. Yeah, well, I did a lot of production work while I was all through school. I was storyboarding, I was PAing, I did everything. But once you sit, you're literally crouching behind Scorsese's directing chair, watching him direct Pesci and De Niro in a massive movie. Mm-hmm. You're like, this is of course the way it always is, this is the kind of this is the dream. Like, if you're gonna visit a set, this is the one, to visit. Because as a kid, you always think every movie's gonna be Gone with the Wind. You'd imagine yourself directing these massive sequences and massive things, and you realize, whatever, you're leading your imagination. Kind of, it's all about what you're trying to say, which is something I eventually learned. But that was a dream, because this is exactly how I almost had envisioned this moment as a kid. Like, that's what I want. And then you're there, and then you have to really kind of stay there.
Yeah, right.
Keep it. And
keep yourself composed, too.
Yeah, so I was very good at being invisible. Mm-hmm. So I was watch everything, never in the way. And then until he needed something, it just kind of materialized. But I would soak in everything. Even to this day, sometimes I'll get an idea or say something and realize it's something that I soaked up so many years ago. And how he solved the problem, but it still continues to be a dream. Just he was able to get me my cut back of the current war, so I could recut the film. I mean, I'm very lucky. Just the fact that his credit is on my film is I'm very proud of that.
It's crazy.
Because his movies changed my life, and anyone that knows me knows that. And basically, anyone could call me at any night, at any time, just talk about Casino or Kundun. Like, you literally can call me 3 a.m. and we'll talk about
hours on it. Yeah,
I just enjoy his movies so much; they really speak to me.
Now, I think at this point, you're on your third directional film, right?
Like, I'm about to direct my fourth. Mm-hmm. And then, but TV, I just did Hunters, which was on Amazon.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And a few other TV, I'm starting to kind of develop my own material. Mm-hmm. And so there's a few things happening with that, too. Who knows when, you know, but yeah.
It's in the process. It's in the works.
Everything is kind of frozen, but you're developing and writing.
Oh,
and
especially right now, right? Because of the COVID stuff, you have to, abide by whatever is going on.
Yeah, so I don't know what I'm shooting next, but it looks like all signs point to one thing, so we'll see.
Now, in terms of, I'm using air quotes here, your legacy as what you want to do as a filmmaker, right? Like, how do you see that ultimately ending up for you in the sense of what you want to leave behind?
I don't know how to answer that.
Yeah.
I mean, Current War did deal with that, with legacy. I always think of people in Laredo and Nuevo Laredo, and they see that I was capable of doing whatever it is that people consider success, in their eyes, that that inspires them also. So that's the only thing I can hope for, as if I am an example to anyone, that that it's just about courage to explore and express yourself and then be true to yourself. And if it is a field that you feel comfortable in and you can excel at, or if you realize that the journey made you aware that you were better off being an architect or a different kind of storyteller or whatever it is, that's all fine. But to having just the opportunity to, because I see a lot of people in my hometown and a lot of students that I've talked to, because I've been, I'm involved, I have a, there's a scholarship there in my dad's name that gives to young artists and things like that. So I'm exposed to a lot of people emailing or calling, and it's almost like they're afraid of that first step, because if they fail, but it's okay to fail. What's would be horrible is never having taken that step and not know what you had in you. There's no way of answering that question without sounding like an asshole, because I can't talk about my legacy. You know, it's like I'm just doing what I think is best and fighting to get the stories that mean a lot to me, and maybe at the end it adds up to something. I hope it does.
Yeah,
you know,
that's it. Comes to the next question. I actually, the reason I brought that up as an example was because you know, I posted it on the Social Primate page, like, hey, look, I'm gonna have a Alfonso Gomez, and there was a lot of people who actually responded, and they were like, what, like how did you manage to get him on, blah blah blah. So I have one question from them here. This they have a podcast as well. It's called the Us Podcast.
Oh, they're great.
Oh,
I'm just chucking in.
Oh, they're great.
I was like, oh, the other good. Yeah, I like them. I like yours.
The question goes, this one gets a little, I don't know how you feel about this one, but it goes, are you conscious of your place in Latino Hollywood, air quotes, and does your identity influence the stories you want to tell?
That's a good question. No, until I'm reminded.
Yeah.
In which case I deny, you know, no, because things come up and they ask you, and there was, you know, a piece recently about the Latinx in the film and TV industry. Mm-hmm. So I get it. But it's not something I think about, you know, because of the way I grew up, I always, and I remember reading a quote, I believe it was Spike Lee, thinking I'm not a black filmmaker, I'm a filmmaker, you know. Same with Scorsese and all those movies. And I think there's something, part of me that was driving me early on is to succeed in a certain kind of system and structure that I connected with or associated with establishment or acceptance. And I think it's because when you're from the border, you're kind of, you have a foot in both countries, but never quite.
Yeah, it's like,
you know, that's what you are. And that's okay. It took me a while to understand, well, that's who you are. That's okay. The identity crisis is your identity, and that's what it's like when you're from the border. And that's it's not a negative. It's how, what makes you so rich, you know, culturally.
I like that. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
You just accept that that's who I am. And it would be easier if I was born on one side and you could just say you're Mexican, or, you know, because I didn't, my sister and I were talking about this not too long ago. I didn't know I was Mexican American until I had to check a box in a PSAT. Because I was just Mexican.
Yeah.
And then it was like, what is this? You know, and it's like Mexican American or Chicano. That was the option. Mm-hmm. And I realized, oh, I get it now. Mm-hmm. But the way I was raised was so specific and strict culturally that it was always Mexican, but because I was literally born in a hospital on this side, now Mexican American, which is a very complicated with a lot of different, you know, varieties, you know, there's Mexican American, there's Chicano, there's Texans, and there's first generation, there's generations that wanted their kids to only speak English, which was the opposite of my parents, and it's just different cultures, you know. But that's what makes it so beautiful, the border. And it took me, well, the Mexican side is all Mexican, you know, which would have been a lot easier, you know, but it was this kind of and that's what made it so interesting. And then had I just owned that earlier, I would have probably been more confident as I was in my early years, because that's what made me interesting to other people, when I always thought it was my own personal problem, less than. So I wanted kind of like to succeed on a, but with time you realize that you know, maybe because I've kind of broken into a certain system now, that I have an opportunity to just say, put the people that I like that maybe look like me in front of the camera, you know, and be more courageous with showing a part of myself, and my culture, on screen. So that's the kind of stuff I'm working on, both in TV and film. It's exploring those avenues. So I'm not aware of it until I'm reminded. Then I do my best and my part, and then I don't think about it.
Right.
Because I think, what if they're wrong? You know?
Yeah. No, I get you. Yeah, I think it's one of those questions, at least to me, that you're being like direct about what it is that you're speaking about, you know?
I know I have... Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. No.
No, I know I have a moment now.
Yeah.
And hopefully a moment lasts forever, where I can make a difference in what I'm doing. I'm doing at least two, hopefully more television series that are mine from the beginning. And they're very much have their Latin experience, whether there's a Mexican storyline all in Spanish, or it's a Puerto Ricans in Sunset Park, or whatever the stories are on the border, or all these things that I'm developing that are an opportunity for, you know, different filmmakers, you know. And actors behind the scenes, in front of the camera, that I can do my part, you know, and also in the feature stuff, which tends to be way more personal for me. And I've kind of buried myself in my movies. Mm-hmm. And I've done only three, but I buried myself in them. And then hopefully the next thing is this show is to not bury myself as much, you know, and show people like me.
Yeah, well, going with that question real quick, I have another user question here. This guy, his name is Ramon.
Know Ramon. He's, I don't know
about he that knows guy. Ramon.
Yeah.
The question is, it's a little paragraph. So it goes, dealing with death in film and art can help demystify the experience, brace or embrace the prospect of it, and help cherish the present that we share with those we care about. Why do you think that's important to convey?
What was the last important to convey? What?
Why do you think it's important to convey those messages in terms of, or I guess those emotions is what he's trying to say.
I think he's talking about Me and Earl and the Dying Girl.
Yeah.
He must be.
Yeah, that's what I think he's referring to.
Although the end of Current War is basically the end of Me and Earl, as someone reminded me recently. Because at the end of the film, Edison projects a memory with him and his wife, and there's a moment when he sees his wife in the kinetoscope, which is basically using filmmaking as consolation,
And, like at the end of Me and Earl.
Yeah, but it was kind of an accident, but subconsciously you probably don't even know until you see it and someone points it out and you realize, I guess I kind of made a very similar film, but which means I'm still dealing with stuff. But that movie was about processing grief of losing your father, and not really, I was, when I lost him, I got kind of lost in work, and thanks to Ryan Murphy, he gave me a break directing in the first season of Glee. I did an episode and I thought it was just like a one-off thing, but luckily I was able to escape in a bunch of American Horror Story and Glee's, and it was like a great time creatively because I was experimenting and I didn't care if I got fired. I was just doing what I wanted to do. I was kind of fearless and in that way, because I was denying everything else around me, so I was just kind of focused on this. And in hindsight, I think there's some good work there, but it was only in facing death head on by making a movie the way the character in the film makes a movie for his friend Rachel that I was able to grieve, and it's about, and that's what I was talking about earlier about personal filmmaking, that it was about expressing what I was feeling, and you know, and giving an abstract kind of feeling a shape, a structure, something that you could actually hold and see, which is a movie, you know, and then you know put it, like I said earlier, like hanging up on your wall or whatever it is, and you move on. And but at least it was able to feel again and give, and then almost it's an expression of love, using the tools that allow me to express myself best, you know. But I know that maybe in communicating something that you're feeling through filmmaking, if it's genuine, I've learned that it's pretty tactile for an audience. And I think that you can really truly communicate and transcend without words, you know, which is why that film had to be kind of an avant-garde experimental film, because at that point, the character Greg was beyond words, you know?
Yeah.
It was beyond anything of what he was feeling. There was no there was he couldn't intellectualize it anymore. He just had to kind of feel. So I was able to, I think, express whether the movie's good or not. I expressed something purely.
Yeah.
And people tend to think that it was communicated, you know, what I was feeling, because it that's why I think people connect with the film. So I don't know what Ramon.
Yeah, Ramon.
I don't know what he was saying exactly, but maybe he means, I don't know what it was about communicating. Yeah. What was it?
Yeah, I guess it's more about, because I guess one of the follow-ups will be like how does a director interpret those truths?
But
like,
did I answer his question? I feel terrible. Keep me up at night.
No,
seriously,
no, I think
fucking discussing Ramon.
I think overall the essence of what he was saying was more like, you know, Me and Neuron and the Dying Girl, for people who haven't seen it, it's a story about a person who, or Rachel, who one of the characters who has leukemia. She has cancer. And, you know, during the whole time, it's like she befriends, I don't want to spoil it for people, but she befriends, or not befriends, the guy Greg is kind of put in the position where he has to befriend her out of guilt, in a sense, you know? And you see how their friendship kind of develops. And, you know, at least from when I saw the film, I guess it's easy for people to be like, oh, this is going to be a romantic film because it's about a guy and a girl getting together. But then you realize that it's really about something more innocent. Like, it's pure about that friendship and just that connection with those people that you don't really see, you know, or connect with all the time. And I think what I'm kind of understood what he was trying to say is that film can put those truths in front of us.
Yeah.
And we're just a I'm just watching from the outside into this character's life. And I'm trying to really figure out, like, what is this character in? Like, what is really going on? And I guess it puts me in their shoes to try to connect.
Because you don't go, I see maybe some do, but I don't go into saying, I'm going to express, you know, grief for the world to kind of, it's just personal.
Yeah.
Like, I'm doing this for really myself, you know, it's like, I mean, this is how I see it. And then that's why I think, again, subconsciously, I really needed to make the movie, was because I think I had an idea that I could potentially let some of this go, let some of the feelings that I was internalizing and compartmentalizing and hiding and running from real life, and let it all out. And it was more after that, the idea that I learned that was in the script, Jesse Andrews' script, about just keeping the conversation going. And the more you talk about someone, the more they're still alive, they're still with you, and you keep learning about them long after they're dead. And that simple idea is enough for me to, like, hang what I was feeling on and see if I could express myself through this process, which is an arduous process of, like, technical, you know, machines and cameras and, you know, all this kind of thing. But at the end, and you hope it comes together with the help of Brian Eno, you know, but it starts with you, I think.
Yeah.
And not coming into, like, it's not for anybody else.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, the whole idea, you know, because if I remember correctly, I think you, it was like a movie in a way, in an honor to your dad, you said, right?
Yeah.
Like you said, there was this part in the movie or in the book, you know, that you presented there that says, like, you can continue seeing somebody's life can continue unfolding after their death. And, you know, I heard that and, like, it's simple, but you're like, oh, damn, that is true. You know, like, somebody's life, whether their physical, the matter that made them doesn't exist anymore, doesn't mean that you can't continue learning about what this person's life was, you know?
And it forced me to start talking more about him.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't. And we were best friends.
Yeah.
You know, but the loss was so, it was just overwhelming.
Damn.
That after this, people start asking you a question about your dad, and you talk a little more freely, you look at pictures a little longer, and then one conversation leads to another, and you learn something about him. And then now you just make it a point. That's why I don't mind talking about him, because it's nice. That's how you keep it out there. And then someone, you know, will look him up, or you hear of someone whose life he changed. And that's why I have this scholarship that in his name, so that all I ask is the young artists who get the money for whatever, they remember who he was. Like, yeah. the scholarship has a name, and you should know who he was. And so that's the most important part of it.
You being the person who's directing this, who basically has to create the visual that people are going to be seeing. I mean, the actors are acting it out, you know, but, you know, like, I'm assuming that whatever you're directing, you're trying to set up in a position where it conveys the message of that particular scene, right?
Mm-hmm.
How is it possible to put something together like that? I know it's the actor's range.
For that sequence or just in general?
Just in general.
In general, I don't know. It's scene by scene. It's like, oh God, it's a whole process. It's getting on the same frequency with the actors. To me, I love actors, so they're an extension of, you know, my imagination, everything I can't do, and it's a mystery to me how they can do what they do, but it's fun to express myself and have them communicate it with a look. You know, it's like,
yeah, it's right. A mystery. That's the magic part.
No, and to be witness to it, you know, and to be close to them when they're doing it. It's just like the greatest feeling in the world. No, it's a frequency that you have to be clear why you're making the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Why me? Why is it important to me? This is what I'm trying to say with it. I think it's really important to lead with that. So everyone gets it. You know, they're there to hopefully fulfill and aid in you communicating what it is that you see. But in talking to actors is finding, you know, bringing a character to life.
Yeah.
And that's the joy. And what are they trying to work through? What am I trying to say with this character? What attracts me thematically to it? And then at some point, you just let it flow. You don't really intellectualize it all the time. And I think all those conversations start really early. Mm-hmm. So by the time you get on set, you have an idea of where it's going and how it's all working together.
But it's
more like your body tells you everything. Mm-hmm. So you just have to kind of trust your gut and know that it feels true and you're trying to get to the truth of a moment, of a scene. And that one, the hospital scene in me and Earl was a combination of their performances was remaining silent.
Yeah.
And the power of this kind of experimental short film, and combined with Brian Eno and in context.
Mm-hmm.
Out of context, it's a very different thing. But if you build up to something in context, it is a transcendent, not that it's a transcendent moment, because that sounds really pretentious. It's when she kind of crosses over into whatever you want to believe in, you know?
Yeah, and definitely was a very powerful ending, I would say. You know, visually, definitely, you know, everything that's happening, we're probably already spoiling it for the people here, but at the end, you know, she unfortunately does not make it, you know, but the way, at least again, because I had seen it before a long time ago, and I resaw it like last week or something to kind of get ready. Kind of like dissecting the stuff, you know.
It's all come down to their beautiful close-ups, you know. It's like Livy Cook and, you know, Thomas Mann and Molly Shannon's. That's the beauty of, that's why you keep doing it over and over and over again. You can get beat down by it, Harvey or whatever it was that's on this last movie, but if you didn't truly love why it was that you made this movie, certainly in the last one, during post on the last one, and the hell that was, I would have given up a long time. Given up on that movie and just letting it go. And you can't because you love it so much, and if it's so compromised that it's not you anymore, you have to keep fighting to the death.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I think I won. I mean, I got it back, and the movie that's out there, I really love. But you do it because you love it. I don't know where I'm saying it. You do it because otherwise, that's what I was going back to, is like that ends, that one, the hospital scene in Mineral, is because that can also happen.
Yeah. You know?
And that's worth a fight. And in the current war, beautiful things happened that had I given up because the beating was so intense.
Like creative differences type of thing?
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah.
But if the beating was so intense that it was so easy to just walk away, as many people that love me very much, because they saw the toll it was taking on me, suggested and recommended, just like, you know, move on. This happens, and you know. But I just couldn't, because there was more work to do, and then my voice was still in there.
Now, do you, like, are these, like, the projects that you approach, are they very, like, do you approach them because you feel like they're personal and intimate to you?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So it's not like, I'm just going to, I mean,
hopefully not.
Yeah, hopefully not, right?
Hopefully, I mean, you never know, but hopefully not. Hopefully it's all, there's a reason behind everything.
Yeah.
You know, whatever, whether it's a horror film or a sci-fi movie, whatever it is, I'd like to connect to someone or mm-hmm. an idea, usually it's something that is something that I'm struggling with or have anxiety about or want to learn more about. But it usually starts with like the self, and then it could be as big as it has to be. It doesn't have to be tiny, you know. It's just as long as I connect to it.
So now I have another user question here related to this. I think we kind of answered this already, but I didn't even type the name of who did ask this, but I remember. It says, do the themes touched on in that film, they're referring to me and Earl, as a director, give you the opportunity to connect with that real human aspect of yourself? Which I kind of feel like you...
Yeah. I mean, I got in touch with... I had the courage to go to grieve.
Yeah.
And understand what that really felt like. And got to the other side of it.
Yeah.
While I was stuck, you know, hiding. So, yeah, I got in touch with something that was very raw.
Connecting to that question, in terms of the, like, the one I didn't get to see is A Current War. Mm-hmm. But I know it was with Edison and I think Tesla, right?
In Westinghouse, huh?
No, yeah, so they were like the old AC/DC currents war. Is that something that when you approached... what was the interest behind it? Was it like the historical?
Not at all.
Oh, okay.
No, it had nothing to do with the AC/DC. I didn't know anything about about that at all.
Yeah.
There were some ideas that I was struggling with for or thinking about for a bit before that. I had gotten out of a film. It was a big studio movie, which of course seems like the dream, but I felt it getting away from me. And it wasn't. I wasn't able to communicate what I really wanted to say with the film anymore. And then what do?
Yeah.
Do you keep going or do you walk away? And I pulled out because I remember even Iñárritu that we talked about earlier, he said, always listen to your body. You know? And it's it was changing on me and I realized that it wasn't me anymore and I could still do it, but then it wouldn't really be me. Mm-hmm. But then I went into like have a dark period there because I think it was my ego was getting the best of me, like what was I really after? You know, the glory or the chance to be a part of a bigger system or a studio thing that I've always dreamed about. But if it was no longer you, then, you know, basically the ideas of how far will a man go to win or how far will you go to be remembered? And then there were these ties between inventors and filmmakers about you want your work to last. And then the things about legacy. And I wanted to examine those sides of me, and in the script it was an opportunity to either be, you know, the self-promoting kind of genius as Edison, not that I'm that, but I'm just saying you're that person that unapologetically wants to put your name on everything and be remembered for your work, or the person that just wants to leave the world a better place, or Tesla, who at the time, you know, will he die a dreamer, which is also a fear, right? That all of us as artists have, you know? And then how do you make a movie about the past that's really about the future? So how do you make a movie that feels like it would have felt at the time as opposed to a stodgy period piece? How do you make a movement that's more rock and roll kind of musical in a way and forward kind of constant motion and that is about the creation of the modern world? That's exciting too, you know, a movie that can hopefully express what it might have felt like to be in that time, which was so many new ideas and inventions that were happening. Even the invention of motion pictures was happening concurrently with that. So this idea that I still think about the inverse kind of correlation between ambition and emotional availability. Mm-hmm. All that stuff was in this movie and that's why. And then the AC/DC stuff. And then someone had to explain that to me. What's with the coil? What? You know? Then I got a handle.
I'm going to have to watch that movie, but I mean...
My mom thinks it's a masterpiece.
Well, if I'm going to see it, I'll be like, yo, your mom's right. First and foremost, like, what drives your interest and your passions in the screenplay? Like, what is it that when they hand you, like, Alfonso, this is what we have for you?
Well, it doesn't work that way, but sometimes I try to kind of develop my own stuff, but yeah, you get submissions sometimes, and sometimes they're amazing. As were, you know, the ones that we've been talking about. Just when you can hear the writer's voice, when it's like it's so specific to a certain voice, that's always fun. You know, you're reading someone that has a unique voice. It isn't just writing things that could be interchangeable with any other writer. And again, if it taps into something that I'm interested in, that you know, sometimes I don't even know that I am until I read it, and I was like, he was able to kind of say something that I start imagining it and I can't shake it. Then you try to reconcile it with like, okay, why and why now, and but mainly why me? Like,
yeah,
great script, but why me? You know, it could be anybody. But yeah, usually it's just like a gut instinct on something, and there's a very clear reason why.
Yeah. Now, do you approach like say you're writing something or somebody gives you something to, you know, kind of read on to see if it's something that matches with you? Like, do you go more for like the feel good themes that like mainstream popcorn films are mostly about, or do you prefer like those nitty gritty parts of the human psyche that explain a story?
I know what I don't like, but I don't think of it that way.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, it really comes from a personal place, and I've learned that. I mean, maybe when I was much younger, you know, I would have made some mistakes and done stuff for the wrong reasons, but no, I don't think about that. You hope that, I mean, I don't think my tastes are so obscure that they're not going to translate, but I just hope I'm not trying to be someone I'm not, you know?
Right. Mm-hmm. Damn. I mean, it must be hard, I would say, because, you know, as a person, as an individual or human, like, we're constantly going through different states, right?
Yeah.
But I don't know. I guess just the fact that you're able to visually, I don't know, how can I say, like, just visually put something together that can carry so much weight and emotion and story is, I've always found it fascinating. Like, I never got into film, but when I was like young, like 8 years old, my dad had like this Hitachi big camera.
Yeah.
And we'll go outside and put some towel around our necks and record something.
Yeah.
And it was fun. It was just fun, like messing with it, you know? But once you get older and you start seeing the behind the scenes and how these movies happen, like the movie magic, it's fascinating, you know? I'm not even a film guy, you know? I
could sit on a set forever. I mean, I still, like, when I'm walking around, I see a truck, I'm like, what are you guys filming? I'm just curious, you know? I could sit. I mean, I got my first job just staring. My first morning in New York, and I crossed the park to go have breakfast at this other residence hall because mine wasn't open yet, and they were shooting Sesame Street in the park, and I just stood there forever.
They had Big Bird and all that?
No, it was like a live action thing. I remember the director's name was this guy named Mustafa Khan. I never met him. I'd like to. And I just stood there forever because I'd never seen anything like that, and one of the people that worked there, she was a production coordinator or something, started putting me to work, and I got my job. Yeah, and I started using it, and I got another job next week. And but I'm just fascinated by the craft. And then like in TV early on, certainly with Glean American Horror Story specifically, it was so much about I couldn't control those scripts, but it's so much about not settling into a certain rule book that I didn't set. So I wanted to, and Ryan always allowed me to do whatever I wanted with the style, to shake it up. And so I'd always experiment, and not feel that this was it for me. I wanted to keep learning. So certainly American Horror, because of the nature of those scripts and the tone of that show, you can go all out and really experiment with lenses and colors, you know, palettes because you had it. Great writing and amazing actors who were game, you know, but it was always about pushing and learning and failing but never just like doing what was expected to get another one. I was fine if whatever I was doing was going to be the last. So I would always kind of like try stuff and sometimes fail gloriously, but it was really fun. And Ryan was all for it all the time, just like get creating and pushing the show stylistically. It was really fun.
I think it's interesting because like Glee is more like a musical. It's more like bright colors, and American Horror Story is like the complete opposite.
Yeah, but you could always do stuff. I had one argument with the DP there on that once because I wanted to use a different lens. He said no. We only use these lenses. I said, no, I want to use this lens. He goes, no, because I'm going to have to relight, because if I go wider, you're going to see all the lights. I said, well, then you relight. Big fights, and then eventually it works, you know? And then even him, then he starts going wider and wider. And the, or it's like movement or editing patterns that you mm-hmm. can design. And because I like musicals very much, you know, so it was always, there's a lazy way of shooting a musical sequence. Yeah. And there was one where, that I learned from like Scorsese, like of really designing it mm-hmm. through to different phrases of music and what is the camera doing at that point. And it was really fun to kind of dissect a piece of music and then try to realize it. It was a great, great time. Yeah. I guess I was avoiding all the personal stuff, but it was such a beautiful world to get lost in for a while.
Now, last question here before we wrap this up.
Is that Ramon again?
Huh?
Is that Ramon
again? No. Ramon's done. Yeah, he's done, please. For the night. But in terms of like the shots that you set up, is that something that you personally decide on, or is that something that's storyboarded by somebody else?
No, God forbid. I mean, like, then it's the ego. It's just crashing in.
Yeah.
It's like the Edison. No, it's... I love to draw. I love to visualize, and I love to sketch, and I used to storyboard for a while as professionally. Now I just doodle, but I do love expressing myself through images and drawings. That said, sometimes it's exactly that.
Yeah.
But very often, when you have a trusted partner in television, it was Michael Goy forever. Fred Elms, the great Fred Elms, did Hunters recently, and you know, Chung Un Chung has shot my last couple of films and a few other things, you know, mm-hmm. commercials and pilot, things like that. But that it's in the, you trust your collaborators so much, certainly your DP, and you just kind of express, this is how I see it, you know. And then in the conversation, sometimes that's elevated, by that triggers a new idea and a new idea, and then that becomes the idea that you shoot. Sometimes you're out of ideas and you go there and it's terrifying, and you just, you know, you trust your actors, you trust mm-hmm. everyone, and then it finds itself in the, or you design something that is wrong because the set is different, or the actor, or the idea of going to A to B doesn't make any sense, so you have to reinvent it. And that's also kind of nice, the way it kind of comes together. But I do like the process of designing it, mm-hmm. whether you adhere to it religiously, as I have sometimes, or sometimes we just kind of have to have it be the sketch of something. I do enjoy that process. Some filmmakers don't, but I do enjoy design sketching it. It goes back to me as like a young kid drawing. I love that process of drawing something and then being able to realize it. But that changes all the time. Sometimes it's like, you know, certainly in TV you get pages the night before, the day of, and there isn't much time, so you just kind of wing it. And then, but yeah, you could always figure it out in a basic way.
Yeah.
But that's not good enough. So what do we do here, you know, that feels right tonally, but also doesn't just fall back into some kind of safety kind of film language just to get it done, because that's not the guy. I hope I'm not that person.
No, it's good. I mean, you continue to push yourself, right? That's
the important point. And fail, but yes, occasionally a success. Yeah.
For those people who are wondering, like, man, I want to start, you know, directing, I want to start filming, I want to mm-hmm. get involved in this. Is there any advice that you have for people starting out?
I just talked to someone the other day who said, again, from my hometown, you know, I mm-hmm. talked to so many people from Laredo, Nuevo Laredo. It was like my thing. And he really wants to be a screenwriter. And I said, do you write? And he goes, no. So that, you know, if you can write, you're a writer, you write.
Yeah.
If you're a filmmaker, and I had no excuse. I mean, I had an excuse early on because I needed access to equipment, because those mm-hmm. video cameras were expensive.
Yeah, of
course. So I had to borrow your friends or this and that, and then eventually you had to go to film school because you had access to equipment, and me also film history and a library, things like that. But now you have a phone.
Mm-hmm.
There's like, it has a great lens that you can do, and then you have Powell and Pressburger, or you know, like you think of Tales of Hoffman or Red Shoes or these movies where the camera was flying and it was the size of your office. It was like these, you know, there was no excuse. Now you have your phone, you have computer, you have the Criterion channel.
Yeah.
You have internet. You can have access to every behind the scenes, every movie. To me, it's just about actually stop talking
mm-hmm.
and like do it.
And
then do you enjoy it? Can you you know, if you want to write, you'll know, your body tells you, did you find that you know what that it feels right?
Yeah.
If not, maybe you can partner with someone to tell a certain story. Do you know what you want to say? Like, what kind of story, why are you telling a story? what, you know, yeah. just like, if you can answer that simple question, like, why me? Like, why do I want to say this? If it's in one word, it's about whatever, ambition or whatever it is, mm-hmm. then you have a hook, right? But I think it's just about if you're writing, you write and you write and you fail and you rewrite and you show it and you get criticized and you do it again. You make a film, the same thing. You start putting it together. It's the one thing is to talk about. One thing is actually bringing all the pieces together.
Yeah,
you have to bring all these people together to follow your lead, and then cut it together and then show it, and then it might be a success or it might be a path to learn how to make the next one.
Yeah.
But it's that courage of picking yourself up and doing it again. And some, you know, will be Mozarts.
Yeah,
right. You know, and we don't like them. we want them to suffer like us. No. But some, there'll be some, you know, Mozart. Yeah. And then other ones are going to be more like, you pick yourself and you learn, it's gonna, you can, that's what, remember one time on my very first one, Town Dreaded Sundown, a movie I love, and a process that was beautiful, and that I was having second thoughts, and I was struggling a bit. I remember Scorsese, we were on the phone for a while, and it was a lifeline call, you know?
Oh, damn.
And there were a lot of things that we talked about. Yeah. The one thing that I do feel comfortable sharing is, he says, if you can find enough, if you can still find yourself in what you're trying to say, and my answer was, yes, I still can, then stick with it, because it'll teach you how to make the next one. And the next one was Me and Earl, because you learn so much from, mm-hmm. from not necessarily failure, because I don't think the film's a failure, but the obstacles that you, and the politics, and,
yeah.
and it could be brutal, you know? And the studio culture, and you know, it was just brutal at times, you know. Yeah. But then you're just that much wiser in the next one. But it's the act of actually stop talking, actually make something, mm-hmm. and then be true to yourself. Okay, this is not me, but this is me. Maybe I'm a costume designer, maybe I'm a art director, or, yeah. or whatever it is. You find the worst thing is to lie by yourself because you like the way it sounds that you're a director, you know, but right, yeah. you much be maybe a brilliant agent or whatever, you know. But I think it's just the do it, be true to who you are. That's the only way you're gonna stand out. If you're trying to copy a trend, mm-hmm. someone already did that and it'll do much better. But if you have something to say that's unique to you, that's how you'll people will hear your voice.
Yeah, damn, man. I know for sure people are gonna reach out to me and be like, yo, this is a good episode. Because I feel like it was great, man. The hour flew by, you know?
Yeah, it was fun. Yeah.
But Alfonso, thank you so much
again
for taking the time. I mean, when was the last movie released? Like 2017 or something, right?
No, that's the problem. Let's talk about this for a second. Because this is the beatdown started. We had one screening. We got into TIFF in a rough cut.
Uh-huh.
I was still battling it with Harvey, what screened at TIFF, which is supposedly a work in progress, was reviewed as a final film.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew we weren't done. We still had months to go. But that was the film that was reviewed, even though it wasn't released for 2 more years, and a very, very different cut. But there's a link. Uh-huh. When you go to Google, it links to a 2017 release that wasn't. It's the power of a screening and the power of not having, you know, whatever, 10, 20 great critics.
Mm-hmm.
Now there are hundreds of bloggers.
Yeah.
And they just destroyed, you know, destroyed me and the film. And it was the beginning of the end of the beginning of the Harvey story in his fall. And it was all cut. And some people even didn't want to re-review the final cut. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it's tied to the 2017 reviews and release. But it's called, the new title is actually The Current War, The Director's Cut. That's the full title,
yeah.
to separate it, differentiate from it from the other one that just called directors. Could be it's the power of the internet and social media that could, you know, that could really hurt you. And everyone that made the movie with you, you know. But it came out last year.
Okay.
It came out in October. Yeah, 2019.
I'll make sure to watch the director's cut.
Yeah, please. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, instead of the old one.
Yeah.
The one that should not be spoken of.
Yeah. I mean, it's all right. It was just a work in progress when I was still battling it out. And fortunately, that's the one that was reviewed as the final piece. And it was 20 years ago. Maybe we can stop it and everyone, you know, just wait until the next one. But, you know, it just got tied into... associated with a much more complex and story, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, hopefully, you know, I'm not sure how soon your next project is going to come out, but just know that there's people looking, waiting for it. So, you know, hopefully next time that it comes out and I see you again in the store, I'll be like...
Well, I'll be here. I'm here every day.
All right, man. All right. Well, again, thank you again for coming out. And then, you know, I hope everybody enjoys the conversation. Man.
Yeah, hope so. Thanks. I really appreciate it.
See you next time.
Down till you touch the